Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. Tonight, I'll be speaking to you on some weighty subjects, but first, a couple of items of interest. Well, which are also pretty weighty. Another holo-revisionist has been put in prison, this time in France, and for 1 year. He is a very well-known and courageous man named Vincent Reynaud, a traditionalist Catholic and the father of 8 children, who has been publishing a revisionist magazine named Sans Concession, meaning something like no concessions or without or not giving up, something along those lines it means, full of pictures. It's mostly about Holocaust revisionism. He's put out many issues of this over a period of a few years. And he was first brought to trial, though, under France's Gaysot law in 2007. And in 2008, he was ordered to pay 60,000 euros to various anti-fascist groups that had brought the case against him and to the court and so on. So if you can't pay the bill, I guess you go to jail. So with 8 children to support, he went underground. And until now, he has been, but now he's been captured. And this Gaysot law, I want you to understand that France has put in place, because they're supposedly, you know, all the laws in the European nations are a little bit different. And this one, which was only passed in 1990, which tells me that it was in response to the success that revisionism was having, prohibits the disputing, quote, the disputing of the existence of one or more crimes against humanity as defined by Article 6 of the Charter of the International Military Tribunal, which is known as the Nuremberg Tribunal, unquote. So we come again to this frozen history wherein what was decided at Nuremberg is protected by criminal law. Absurd to any thinking individual, but it is the best evidence you can find that we have been under a political mafia since that time that rules not through truth and democracy, but through suppression and dictatorship. The Nuremberg Tribunal was one of the most blatant false show trials in all known history. But that's what we're forced by loss of freedom to adhere to. We lose our freedom if we don't. We were put in jail. So that's a loss of freedom in itself by living under laws like this. And so someone like Vincent Reynaud fights it as a freedom fighter. That's how I see him. And now another victim of this system was just condemned to a prison term of 5 years, and that is Gerd Honsik of Austria. He was living in Spain for many years to avoid a prison term of 4 years that was put on him quite a long time ago, simply for being a nationalist and espousing the view of a united Germany, meaning the annexation of Austrian Germany. It's forbidden in Austria to say anything good about National Socialism or the Third Reich, to praise it in any way, and in fact, it's a crime. But Honsik, whose father was killed in the war when he was very young and was brought up by his young mother to admire his father's beliefs, has been a German nationalist all his life. I think he's been involved in publishing, but he's always been circumspect in what he says and how he says it in order to avoid being prosecuted under these laws. But they go after him anyway, and eventually, as I say, he had to go to Spain, but now they extradited him from Spain, brought him back to Austria, and I believe it's completed. He's got 5 years to serve. I don't know if he's appealing. I'm afraid I didn't look up the latest here before the show, but all these stories are tragic, but they're also inspiring and show us the mettle of our courageous brothers and allies in this battle against the suppression of truth. The truth about World War II and everything that went along with it and what has followed from it is what they are afraid of. They, who are the upholders of this system, feel they cannot allow it, even at the cost of being criticized, which they are, and shown for what they are by their ridiculous draconian laws. The subject about World War II is my subject tonight, or the truth about World War II is my subject, and I'm so very pleased to have Dr. Wilhelm Christman with me to take a look at new evidence and new books asking the question, the big question, who started World War II? So this is a big question, and I want to welcome Dr. Wilhelm Christman once again to my program. Thank you, Dr. Christman, for being patient.
Well, thank you for having me again, and I'm always looking forward to talk with you about different topics. So whenever you are ready, let me know, and let's start.
Okay. Well, we're going to start with a book that came out a couple years ago, but it's still fairly new, by Viktor Suvorov, called The Chief Culprit, and the subtitle of the book is Stalin's Grand Design to Start World War II. And we have both read the book, and we both have read quite a few other things and have opinions on who started World War II. So we're going to use his book in large part to see what kind of an argument he makes and what we think of it and what conclusions we come to. Now, I'll just start out by saying that the historiography of World War II, as you would agree with, I think, is that Hitler was the aggressor everywhere. This is the this is what refers to what I was talking to right before this about the Nuremberg trials and what was established and how it's been upheld by suppression of any other views ever since then. So this is what they want. This is how it's held up. And everyone who was involved in that war is quite happy with that assessment because it leaves them off the hook. But this book, he makes quite a good case for the Soviet Union preparing extensively for an offensive against Germany and then all of Europe once Germany was weakened enough by its battles with France and then with Britain. And we're going to talk about that. So I'm going to ask you what kind of a case does Suvorov make, in your opinion, Dr. Christman?
Well, I think the core of his book is really about 10, 15 pages long and starts with June 13th, 1941. And those chapters in detail describe the massive accumulation of Russian forces in the 4 or 5 days. What he calls the first and second strategic echelon of Soviet forces moving in the 5 military districts very close to the new border which was lined up after Germany defeated Poland and was bordering now with the Soviet Union. It's amazing that this massive movement, operational, strategic, from way back in the military districts in the Ural and Baikal area, was done in top secret, and all the documentation which Suvorov was able to do were noted in the VIC, which is the Soviet military archives. So there is no doubt that those movements were primarily offensive and ready for attack to Germany. And again, I mean, the massive forces, those are close to 1 million military forces which were moved already from early 1941 on. I mean, in February, March, April, May, And in the 4 days, June 13th, 14th, 15th, that was kind of a general mobilization. And all along, from the Baltic Sea down to the Black Sea, the Soviet first echelon forces were moving close to the German border and fully equipped with all the forces of necessary for an aggressive offensive, like artillery, airplanes, tanks, rifle divisions, and all the necessary supply materials.
Well, how do we know that this movement toward the border wasn't defensive? That, you know, I'm sure that will be argued that this was, they were wary of Hitler. They had reason to believe, maybe they even knew that he was planning his own invasion, and so they were moving all this up to the border, to the further west, to protect against that. How do we know that?
Well, I think the mass of complete equipped divisions, corps, tanks, 10,000, over 10,000 tanks, over 10,000 airplanes. Those are not defensive weapons. Those are offensive weapons, and amassing on the border for defensive. I mean, there was no deep defensive army troops or equipment ready there. It was all obvious accumulation for an offensive operation. You don't move that massive troops close to, well, it was about 6 to 15 miles close to the border in order to defend it. It's, and there were no, all the former defensive lines like bunker lines and so on, they were all demolished already way before the big movement started.
Yes, he also, Suvorov also shows that all of the communications and all of the planning that he presents, where he says he gets it from the archives and so on. Now, as we have both agreed upon, we're not saying that he is absolutely right about everything he says. And there are people who criticize him, and there are people who don't criticize him in what he presents in his book. That well, he didn't have access to what he says he didn't, little things like that. But that really is not important. That does not matter.
But, you know,
and the fact is that all of the evidence shows that, from what Stalin said, all of his marshals, and was that they were not interested in defensive war ever, and that communism did not even fight defensive wars. Communism only fought offensive wars on their opponents' ground, not on their own ground. So they didn't plan in the least. They were never planning for a defensive war. There's no evidence in everything, including the evidence of what they actually did, which you were just describing.
Usually military defense, if you don't put your forces right in front of, exactly, of the border, where you deep, right, you echelon it up. I mean, usually the first miles of territory and areas you leave open, and then line up your defenses. But then it's very often, I mean, he's quoting specifically the arrangements and all the orders in the military district of Kiev, which is strategically, geographically very important for any offensive towards Germany. And I mean, it was top secret, and they moved at night. And even the That's division right. commanders themselves didn't know what was going on. I mean, it was all under the pretext of summer maneuvers. And on top exactly. of that, I don't know if you noticed, there was a radio message on the TASS message where they said, well, there is no plans of aggressive, attacking Germany. On the contrary, we are friends, and our pact is more than ever valid, and we exchange our goods across the border. So that was all the hypocritical actions in order to cover up the real purpose of the aggressive operations.
Yes, and that moving everything at night, and as you say, yeah, they made it appear that it was everything that they were doing, even their training and so on, previous to that, was a part of just their training exercises. And it was extremely detailed planning to keep it, as you say, top secret. And, you know, I don't have the understanding that you do, but I do understand now that in defensive war, you keep your troops back and you have a lot of obstacles and you set a lot of mines. Now, also, what they did was they removed all of that that had been put in place in various places along the border, mines, landmines, you know, and they unmined all their bridges. They had nothing mined, so that this allowed the Germans, because of their surprise attack, to just go right through. They, you know, this was really devastating for the Soviet Union, because
it proves that there were massive forces on the flanks. It's in the north, it's called the Suwalki, but in the south, around Lov Lemberg. And it proves, and that was all, it was just in the final process of setting and deploy all the forces for the attack, 14th, 15th, 16th of June. The German preventive action was on the June 22nd. And what happened in the first 2-3 weeks, it's proof that this massive 100,000, well, close to, I think in the first encirclement battles altogether around Minsk and Lov, and then later on Kiev, there were close over 500,000 prisoners on tanks, over 10,000 tanks, airplanes. They were all located close to them, ready for action. This is not defense. This is very obvious offensive plans. And then,
all right. So why was Stalin and his? They had an excellent intelligence service and ability. Excellent, maybe the best in the world. And they've had it even during the Cold War and so on. That excellent intelligence and spies and so on. Why were they taken by surprise like this? Because Germany was also having to mass its forces.
You know, Stalin had warnings from all directions. I mean, one of the first warners was Churchill himself. But Stalin didn't believe Churchill, because he said Churchill had his hidden plans on the other side, he had...
Yeah, I want to make the point, just interrupt you for a second, that from what I've gathered, Stalin never trusted Churchill, all right up to the end, and until once he was invaded, then they became allies. I don't know, he still didn't trust
him. I doubt that he trusted anybody.
He didn't.
Even his internal Politburo, well, it proves, I mean, he got rid of some of the most intimate advisors of him, Yagoda Beria, and Trotsky, and Voroshilov, and Tukhachevsky. I mean, all those in the years. He was a very brutal dictator, and I don't think he trusted anybody. And he didn't trust all these messages and reports from very reliable agents, like, for instance, Viktor Sorge in Tokyo. I mean, he warned him. He gave him the exact date of the German offensive, and he also gave him the information that the Japanese forces will not attack his Siberian army there, but go south towards the British colonies and Singapore, and that enabled him to move in the winter offensive of counteroffensive in 1941. All these fresh Siberian divisions west of Moscow. And then he had his agents in Switzerland told him, but he didn't, I don't know, maybe he thought that Hitler will not take the risk and
well, this is what is put forth, and there's lots of evidence for it, that he was convinced that Hitler was an intelligent, reasonable, thinking person, and that he would never go for a two-front war, that he was greatly afraid of a two-front war, which he was, and he didn't want to. And Stalin was counting on Hitler doing the British invasion, continuing to finish off Britain when before he turned on the Soviet Union. He knew he expected him to do that, but he didn't think he would do it until he had the British defeated to some degree. But Hitler realized that if he was tied up with occupying Britain, this was the Sea Lion operation, which we have written about, and so many people blame him for not completing that and not doing, thinking that he would have won the war if he would have taken over Britain. Baloney, because that's exactly what Stalin was waiting for, and then, you see, he was going to attack, and he thought that Hitler was involved in this invasion plan and so on, and to the extent that now would be a good time for him to make his attack.
Well, you know that Hitler was well aware what happened to Napoleon in the Winter War in 1812 and 1314. But he was forced to him, and he decided that he had to take the risk in order to avoid the tremendous threat of Russia. I mean, and raw materials, for instance. He was depending on the oil from Romania, he was depending on the chromium, on the nickel from Norway, and wanted to have an open sea in the Baltic Sea, and wanted to have protection enough in Romania. And that those considerations probably, plus the fact that he probably believed that, not probably believed, that the German forces were ready to get to Moscow within 2-3 months.
On June 9th, 1940, which when Germany was just in deciding what to do about invading Britain, or, you know, how to, well, I don't even think the whole France had been taken over yet. But Zhukov, one of Stalin's most important marshals, formed a southern front on the Romanian border. And they had already, at that time, taken over Bessarabia and Bukovina. And that was aggressive. They had no right to do that, but they just did it. There was nothing really Hitler could do about it. He didn't have the ability to stop Stalin from doing what he was doing, because he didn't have the forces available. So Zhukov formed the southern front on the Romanian border, made up of three whole armies. And then he grabbed Bessarabia and northern Bukovina. And then he was just sitting there. Those armies could very easily have gone and cut Germany off from its Romanian oil, and that would be the end of his military operation. So,
well, I think he was
a threat. And so Hitler sees this idea of going into Britain and all that it would entail, and how it would tie him up, his armies up completely. And there, and then he sees what Stalin is doing, and he makes a decision to leave Britain alone and turn to the east. And
I think he was fully aware, after the visit of Molotov in October 1940 in Berlin, when Molotov was very point blank. I mean, they were talking, and he was talking about sphere of interests, and it was way beyond the originally agreed spheres of interest, where Russia, Soviet Union, well, claimed naturally their interest on Finland, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, and on the other side you mentioned down Bessarabia and Bukovina. But he went beyond that. I mean, he went it and wanted to claim as a sphere of interest Bulgaria and all the way to the western part of the Black Sea, the Bosporus and Turkey.
And yes, Dr. Christman, I'm going to have to stop you right there, because we have to take our break. And so we will pick this up as soon as we get back. Ladies and gentlemen, hang on. We'll be right back.
be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
The Boucher reactor has nothing to do with nuclear weapons-grade fuel at all. It's a light water reactor. And, in fact, George Bush had said that he was perfectly fine with the operation of the Boucher reactor since the Russians would be providing the fuel and would be removing all the waste. It's basically impossible to harvest plutonium out of this reactor for use in any weapons without the whole world knowing. And, of course, Iran is still within their safeguards agreement. And the Boucher reactor just has nothing to do with the nuclear weapons program at all. In fact, I think the Israeli journalists, Yosef Melman and the other guy, I forgot his name, in their book said that the Israeli government themselves have backed off the claim that Boucher is part of a step forward in any nuclear weapons progress in Iran whatsoever. Any war with Iran would be a disaster. I think that's why the Pentagon is against having a war. There's actually an article in the New York Times today about the Americans calming down the Israelis and reassuring them that if there is any sort of nuclear weapons threat in Iran, it's not immediate, and they still want to work, use diplomacy to work things out. I think if you actually look into what the war party says about any plan for war with Iran, they always just kind of allude to the idea that if America starts bombing Iran, that the people of that country will rise up and overthrow their government for us and do a regime change for us. No one contemplates actually sending in ground forces to Iran. The only question is, if there are airstrikes, whether they'll be focused on the nuclear program, perhaps some more military targets, or whether they would be an attempt to take down the regime. But, of course, the idea of taking down the regime from the air is nonsensical. The people of Iran, as soon as the first bomb goes off, will rally around their government the same way they did when Saddam Hussein invaded back in the 1980s, the same way Americans responded when we were attacked on September 11th. So we will not get a regime change in Iran. I think it's very likely that the Mahdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr and the leftovers of the Badr Brigade in Iraq could rise up against the 50,000 combat forces that Barack Obama has continued to leave in that country. I think American forces in Afghanistan would also be a risk. Whether Iran actually has the capability to take out American naval vessels in the Persian Gulf, I'm not sure. But they certainly could sink oil tankers and probably close the Straits of Hormuz, which would drive the cost of oil through the roof and endanger what's left of the world economy at this point. And offer a nuclear weapons program that does not exist. There's no Manhattan Project in Iran. Every bit of their nuclear program is safeguarded by the International Atomic Energy Agency under their safeguards agreement. They're not in violation of that. They're only in violation of UN resolutions that demand that they cease their peaceful uranium enrichment, which the UN Security Council has no right to demand. And if America would just live up to our own end of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, we would recognize their right to enrich uranium at Natanz. But you know, the effect of having a safeguarded enrichment facility means that the IAEA inspectors are verifying that none of the uranium is diverted to any military or other special purpose. So it's all still sitting there at industrial grade, 3.6%. And it would have to be above 90%, in fact, above 94% to really make an atom bomb out of it. And they would not be able to even begin construction on an atom bomb like that without withdrawing from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, kicking the inspectors out of the country, and announcing to the whole world that they're doing so. So, you know, so far the Iranian position, since the Axis of Evil speech, has been to say, we have our hands up, don't shoot. We're not making nuclear weapons. Let your inspectors in. So, you know, all that.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and my guest is Dr. Wilhelm Christman, and he was just explaining the further claims of sphere of interest of the Molotov in on behalf of the Soviet Union in Bulgaria and the further into the Balkans at the very time between, let's say, in 1940. So please continue, Dr. Christman.
Well, that was Molotov's visit in Berlin in October 1940, and in a very tough meeting discussions, to the surprise of the Germans, Molotov was very forcefully claiming additional spheres of interest. And indeed, he said, well, we have definitely political and military interest in Bulgaria, and beyond that, we want the control of the Dardanelles in the western exit of the Black Sea. And these claims, I mean, in Hitler, Molotov requested already some verbal and even written protocol understandings and signed signatures. But Hitler and his staff and Ribbentrop did not comply to that request, and Molotov left after 2 days. And I think that was one of the decisive moments when Hitler realized, I mean, that's, there is no other way but take the risk and come and final military confrontation with the Soviet Union.
Yes, it's my conclusion exactly that Hitler realized even earlier than that that he had to deal with the Soviet Union, because he realized that Stalin was waiting for him to get involved, as I probably already said, in more further in Britain, and an invasion would tie up, you know, occupying that
well, island probably
and all of those problems, and then that would leave Stalin open season there to invade Germany and then go on into the rest of Europe that was already weakened and worn out by the war. So Hitler realized that, so he didn't have any choice. He couldn't finish off the Western Front, and he couldn't ignore the Eastern Front, and Germany, situated as it is in Central Europe, has always had this problem. It's not foolishness that they get involved in so many wars on so many fronts. It's because they have so many fronts, and if they're attacked from these places, they have to act. And so Hitler did, as you say, make that very wise.
Well, I don't think he was right away. I think I think 1943 was the aim of the final solution, or to say the final confrontation with the Soviet Union. But the situation at that time, 1940, he realized there's not time left anymore. And he lost already operational time through this campaign in Yugoslavia and Greece that took about nearly 2 months.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and of course, as you say, if the plan was for 1943, then it was they would have time to build up for it. So I think that Germany was not fully prepared. Really, they weren't well enough prepared to invade this huge nation of the Soviet Union. But he felt, because he knew he had to make the first strike, and that was his only hope, to make the first strike and surprise them and make huge gains right in the beginning. That's why he did that, even though he really didn't have the forces to go up against these Russian forces. And it turned out that we know now that Russia was, the Soviet Union was prepared to strike Germany and then move on through Europe and on all this, along this whole front, in like July of 1941. So it turned out strangely, as though, you know, Hitler is known to be someone who had some kind of higher power guiding him, or he was in touch with, he was always lucky, you know, he fortunate, he seemed to have the right, and he would make, he was moved in large part, well, in some part, by his instincts for things, his feeling for
things. Well, you know, there's...
And he did that and turned out to be brilliant, because Germany would have been crushed in July by the Soviet Union, considering what we know of what they were amassing on
well,
the border.
You know, according to Suvorov's chapters in it, beginning with this chapter number 34, June 13th, it was, again, I think I'm repeating myself, but the middle June, from June 13, 14, 15, at least 80-90% of the operational moves for an aggressive war were more or less finished. And that proves that Hitler's consideration were risky, but they were properly, and the preventive strike was the only thing which was available for him, and that's how they had to attack on June 22nd, and probably were ahead of maybe 1 or 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, I think that can be now be shown. Those who are very critical of Suvorov's book, I think, are doing so based on the fact that they don't want to change the historical account of the aggressiveness, you know, from the Nuremberg account that Hitler was guilty of aggressive war and nobody else was, because he makes it very plain that Stalin was guilty of aggressive war, and he was certainly guilty of invading Finland.
I wonder if there was any, and I'm not aware of any severe critique by Western historiographers about Suvorov's book and Suvorov's findings. And I mean, again, those are endnotes. He had documentation and had a way to look at military archives which were not open to anybody of the traditional historians. I'm not aware that any heavy criticism specifically in those pages where he proved
it. There is some coming from certain people, and truthfully, I don't know, there's somebody named David Glantz. Is he Jewish? It's people, it's coming, I think, from people who have a vested interest in not changing the history. But let's go back to 1939, September 1939, which is the so-called the beginning of World War II, because that's what I've called this this topic tonight, and who started World War II. So we have Hitler wanting to solve his problem with Poland, and we have the Soviet Union agreeing to this Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact.
Mm-hmm. Before the signing of the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact, there was a delegation of the Allies, British, primarily British, French delegation in Moscow, to sign up Stalin in their defensive pact, including France, Great Britain, Poland, and the Soviet Union. And in the case of a war, which was obviously only a war against Germany, they wanted to have the alliance of the Soviet Union. Now, an alliance, strategic, operational, there was still Poland between Germany and Russia. And Stalin and his staff, Zhukov, for instance, and Walitsyn, they demanded a kind of a corridor so their armed forces and their military power can march through Poland and attack Germany. Well, Poland never would have allowed that, and they didn't agree, and this is why those negotiations were broken off. And at the same time, Stalin had already feelings towards Germany, and a few days later, the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact was signed.
Yes. Yeah. Germany signed it because they thought it would protect them from that threat from the Soviet Union, so they could continue with their interests.
The efforts of coming to understanding with Poland goes way back into, there was the 10-year non-aggressive pact with Pilsudski. There was it's the legacy of the Versailles Treaty. Germany lost through the treatment of Versailles, yeah, a direct connection with the easternmost province, East Prussia. That was a completely separated, and Poland was in between. Now, Hitler's effort was to have some connection, landway, a corridor with East Prussia. And he wanted to know, but he did negotiate that with Poland. He agreed that Poland will have a free spot at the Baltic Sea. He demanded a plebiscite in Danzig, but Poland, after they had the reassurance of the Allies, was arrogant and did not want to talk and negotiate.
Yes, well, yeah, and we've covered that. So now, what we had, though, is that what I see is that Stalin was watching this, and he thought he would make this agreement with Hitler, and he thought that Hitler, and he knew, according to Suvorov, Stalin was sure that their joint invasion of Poland would bring Britain and France into the war, whereas Hitler was advised and believed that Britain and France wouldn't turn it into a larger war. Stalin, if this is correct anyway, Stalin was correct, and so he thought that he planned on Britain, Germany, France, and all getting into a big war and wearing themselves out. This is the communist strategy. We let them fight among themselves. We stir up trouble among themselves. It's also the Jewish strategy, which the communism was Jewish. And then we come in and take over. And so this was Stalin's overall plan. Britain's plan was to keep Germany from becoming too strong and hoping that it would get involved in a fight with the Soviet Union. So that's why Britain attacked. Britain wanted a war. Britain wanted the war. Stalin wanted the war. It was only Hitler who really did not want a war. The last thing he wanted, a war. He never thought it would start a general war. When he went into Poland, he thought Stalin was going to attack from the other side, and they were supposed to, and they didn't. And when confronted, Stalin said he didn't think the time was right. I mean, Molotov probably said that. I mean, this is the way they talk. You know, well, we didn't think it was right for us to do this. So what can Hitler do? So they finish fighting the war, and then they still have to allow the Soviet Union to take their half of Poland. And the whole thing is that what I'm trying to say is that Hitler was pulled into all of this and then blamed for it. And I think I could continue if I had more time, and you could too, but time is short, so I turn it back over to you.
Well, I think Hitler thought that his Polish campaign will be a local one. Something similar what happened at the Anschluss with Austria and the Sudetenkrise. And, that didn't work out that way because Poland had the protection of Great Britain. And as you said, Great Britain and the Alliance, they wanted a war with Germany.
So there's a question then, Dr. Christman. What would you say to answer the question? Who really started World War II?
Well, it was, I think it was an overall conspiracy between Churchill and Stalin.
But not in 39. I don't think in 39, fall of 39, Churchill and Stalin were conspiring together, but they both had their vision.
Well, already at that time, you know, when Churchill took over the government in Great Britain, he had already in his mind, he didn't want to destroy Hitler. He wanted to destroy Germany. And because he was afraid of the economic and political power of Germany, and he knew that only could happen with the super military power of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, so it wasn't like they were actually conspiring together at that point, but their interests coincided to want to destroy Germany. Well, Britain wanted to destroy Germany. Stalin wanted to take over Germany. He really wanted to take over a prosperous Germany, a strong Germany, and make it communist. You know, would you agree with that? He didn't want to destroy everything in his path. He wanted to take it over and make it a part of his communist union, his Soviet Union.
Stalin did, but yes. Churchill wanted the destruction of Germany.
Yes,
and
exactly.
It proved. I mean, if you see what happened in 44, 45, attacks of the air forces and the destruction of that was annihilation of a nation.
Yes. Okay. So they both had the interest in World War, in having a large war, didn't they? Both Britain and the Soviet Union had this interest in having this big war. Why would Hitler have an interest in having it? He did not have the means. When World War, in September 1939, he was absolutely unprepared to start a major war. Absolutely. And as you have pointed out to me in the past and in books and so on, it wasn't until 1943 that Germany really got a good military production going. Up until then, they were still way behind. They weren't putting out what was necessary. And I have said that it's just the strength of the German people soldiers that they did so well.
That's another point of offensive and aggressive attacking. The armaments of the Soviet Union, I mean, there's one typical example, the tank, the T-34, which was the most advanced tank at that time in the early 40s, 41, 42. I mean, that was a typically aggressive offensive weapon. And the same thing goes to a large extent also for the Soviet Air Force.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And they had how many of those tanks? And compared to the number of tanks that that Germany had, it was
at least three times to four times as far as numbers are concerned.
Exactly. And Hitler had made the point, had said after they had invaded and found out the extensive preparation, military material that Soviet Union had, that he had no idea, and his intelligence had really failed him in preparing him to know. But in the same time, he had no choice but to attack. And his first strike turned out to be, in retrospect now, the best thing he could have done. You know, even in spite of his weakness, of Germany's weakness compared to the Soviet Union, it was still because they were able to make a great advance. And as to final summing up, in my opinion, based on everything we've said, if Germany had not made its first strike attack against the Soviet Union, all of Europe would have been overrun by this tremendous war machine that Stalin had prepared and was ready to use.
I think, I don't know if you mentioned that, but I think this immense initial victories were close to, in the first 2 months, close to a million Soviet army was destroyed. That was the final signal that world communism could not proceed.
Yes.
And that was one saving declaration of Hitler's victory, that he saved Europe for a total communist takeover. They were then still able in 45 to advance all the way to the across the Oder River and for 30 years occupy and influence the eastern part of Europe. But those initial victories in 1941 really made it impossible for Stalin to occupy whole Europe.
Well, I agree with you on that. And he was aware of that. It took him a while. He was in denial for about a week, Suvorov says. But then he was working long days with his generals and so on, but he didn't understand fully what this all meant to his plans of world revolution. But after about a week, it started to sink in on him. They were still trying to make offensive moves, and when they finally realized that they had to go into defense, and they weren't prepared to in the least, because they had never ever planned defense in their entire history of their communist nation there, only offense.
You know,
so then he was forced to do that. That's when it dawned on him that he could no longer, his plan was
you
was
know
gone.
That it's also a personal note on that justifies all our young, including me, why we were willing to fight for Hitler and for the Third Reich. It was partly defending Europe from communism. And that's what we thought, youngsters at that time, mm-hmm. that we are doing not for Germany our duty only, but for the salvation of Europe.
Well, and I think it turns out now that's the absolute truth. That's what it is. Suvorov makes this point at the end of the book that the popular idea is that Stalin was so shocked by this invasion, and he was so unprepared, and he went into a panic, and then this panic, he went into this big depression immediately. And disappeared, but this didn't happen to him immediately. It wasn't until a week into it that he realized that his overall plan was gone, and he thought that his own people were going to come and arrest him, because he had, you know,
yeah, that's a very interesting.
And he went to his dacha, and he holed up there, and then a delegation of the party went to visit him, and he looked at him suspiciously, wouldn't say a word. He was sitting in a chair all humped over, and yeah. He thought they were coming to arrest him, but they had decided they had to prop him, they had to keep him on because for the people, to rouse the nation, because they realized now that they had to go into a defensive mode, and they had to save themselves, to save the nation, and save their communist country. And so they needed Stalin as the head person, and when Stalin saw that was the case, well, then he revived, and then they went on into what they did from then on. But the point making is that Hitler ruined Stalin's plan. He really did. And in that way, Germany really did, with all its sacrifice, did save Europe. And this is something that it is totally opposite to the historiography that we have today, that they were evil, that they had turned, that all Germans had turned bad, it turned rotten, that they were terrible aggressors trying to take over the world. Nothing could be further from the truth. It's amazing, and this needs to be spoken out again and again. I'm so happy that Suvorov wrote this book. He started it with The Icebreaker, and I don't care how much he tries to make Hitler into a kind of a guy who was being played on by all sides, and I don't agree with that, but I do agree that the whole thing was a manipulation, and that he probably stands out, as I've said before, as one of the most honorable of all these players in this World War II scenario. I was going to mention something about Hess and the Hess flight, because a listener had written to me and wanted me to talk about it. The idea of the Hess flight was that they understood that Hitler was terribly concerned with making peace with, he really wanted to make peace with Britain, so that because of the threat from the Soviet Union, not because he wanted to take over the Soviet Union right then, but because he saw the threat taking that was there, and he needed to free himself from this war with Britain. But the British would not go along with it. But when they saw how serious he was about his peace proposals, they decided to use it as a trap, and it was entirely an intelligence op that there was a group in Britain that was interested in that, and they worked on with some secret talks and secret approaches. And so it was decided that an emissary would come to meet with this group, which was really an intelligence group. But they had no idea that this emissary was going to be Rudolf Hess. And I'm not at all convinced that Hitler knew it was going to be Rudolf Hess, but that Rudolf Hess decided that it was going to be him, and he took off and he went. And they didn't have the lights on for him to land. He was totally dark, and he had to crash land and parachute out. And when they discovered it was Rudolf Hess, they were so astounded, they didn't know what to do. And the word got out that it was him. From then on, he was held by them. They wouldn't let him talk. They wouldn't let anything out, because they were afraid. What they didn't want out was that they had used a serious and sincere peace proposals to do an intelligence op in order to gain military advantage. And this is a no-no in the rules of war and so on. Is that not correct?
Well, the whole Rudolf Hess affair is still shrouded in mystery. And I think we will not know exactly what happened. I think he did it on his own. And he might have an idea that he is going to meet the proper people at around the Duke of Hamilton. But on the other side, there are very direct indications that the British Secret Service played the role and that they just tried
to... I believe it was entirely a Secret Service, an intelligence operation. There weren't this group of people, or this group of people allowed the British intelligence to use it, take over. And so he was, Hess was totally duped in his Hofhaus, that whole thing. Well, that will have to wait for another time. We're really going to have to say goodnight. I thank you so much. I think this has been a very interesting program. And I thank you so much, Dr. Chrisman.
Well, I thank you, and what a pleasure to have you talking again, Wayne. Thank you.
All right. Good night, everyone. See you next week.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com. ¶¶